For the first portion of this, I'm going to use this vastly underused resource here, which is, I don't really know what the name of it is, but look at how awesome this is. How am I not going to use this? Come on, step up here, and of course, close the little door to indicate that this is not egalitarian here. There's the speaker, and there's the rest of you folks. So, all right, well, I'm running a little experiment tonight. I'm going to have a little wine as this goes. Now, I have a very, very low alcohol tolerance level. My wife can attest to this. You see? But I just thought, to make this interesting for you guys, let's just see what... It would be just another variable, okay? Now, of course, in order for this to take effect, I am going to have to drink it like a Philistine, so you'll see me gulping it down. But anyway, what I'm going to do tonight is something a little bit different from what I've done in the past at this thing. The Institute for the past few years has been inserting into your program this thing called An Evening with Tom Woods, and they don't tell me what it is that they want me to do. And I think the first time they did it because I hadn't given them a topic, so they thought, all right, this deadbeat isn't going to reply when we ask him for a topic. We'll stick it to him. We'll just give him no topic at all and then watch him flounder out there. So I wound up talking 2 years ago about my little story, because we all have a story, right? How we got here, how you got to Auburn, Alabama, talking about these sorts of things. So I told that, and I was kind of happy with how that came out. So then last year I thought, I got to do something different. And each time I do this, the next day, or the day after Mises U is over, I think to myself, I have a whole year to think up something new and interesting to do on The Evening with Tom Woods. And then, of course, as you know, I think about nothing but this nonstop for the next year until the day before the thing comes, and I say, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? So last year, I talked for a little while, and then we went out into the audience, and we took questions, but specifically, we were asking, what are the objections that you guys encounter most often? And let's see if we can respond to them together. And that was great because a lot of you faculty folks were in here. And when I didn't know the answer, which was more often than not, I could just punt it, you know, hey, Roderick Long knows about this. Or maybe there's some situation in which somebody else might know something. And it all turned out great. So, yeah, and Roderick said, no, there's no way he would know the answer to something. Okay, well, so now what I want to do is something that's altogether different. You notice there are three seats that are not yet taken. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, it's going to be the triumvirate. It's going to be Lou Rockwell, the judge, and Ron Paul coming out. No. None of those people will be sitting in these seats in the next hour. Or probably during the week. I mean, of course, you know, Lou and the judge will be here tomorrow. That's going to be a lot of fun. That's good, good. We want that kind of enthusiasm. Okay, and by the way, that'll be me after I finish this class here. All right, so what I want to do, though, tonight is talk to a few people here who are going to help you navigate through this week. And also, I want to talk about some of the topics that are of interest to you guys. And the way I'm doing this is I'm going to bring up a couple people. We're going to sit over here and chit-chat about, well, you'll see the topics. But the third figure I'm going to have come up is a guy you love, we all love, it's impossible not to love, and that's Walter Block. We're going to have Walter. Walter's going to be part of this. And the reason Walter's going to be part of this is that, as you all know, Walter's an economist. He's got a distinguished scholar chair. He's written 800 gazillion articles. And, in fact, the opportunity cost of his being here is like 5 articles. So we're very grateful to have him with us. When I co-authored an article with him years ago, I really felt like a major milestone had been reached in my career. But Walter is known, in addition to being an economist, as being somebody who is an excellent theorist on libertarian questions, or at the very least, somebody you would go to when you're stumped on some question. Or if you have some oddball, out there sort of objection, Walter is the guy who will answer. And you'll always see, you'll see throughout the week that in between sessions or at night, you'll see a circle of people somewhere in this room, and it'll be Walter talking. And all the students go, oh, yeah. Okay, so we're going to give you a little preview of that tonight. So the sort of question that I want you to ask Walter is not like, how did you get interested in economics? No, we're just going to throw that in the garbage. You're going to ask him that privately. I want to challenge Walter, right? We want to challenge this guy, right? And we're going to challenge him with questions like, I mean, this is just an example. This is the sort of thing Walter just knows. Suppose we woke up one day and half the petunias suddenly were rational. So then the question would be, would 100% of the petunias be entitled to rights now? Now, not only does Walter know the answer, he has 5 articles on the rational petunia question. All of them co-authored, of course, with one of them with a petunia, I understand. All right. Yeah, one of the rational ones. All right. So, but here's what I'm going to do. To maximize our time together, this paper, this is special. It looks like ordinary paper to you guys. This is special Walter Block question paper. So I'm going to send it around, and if you want to ask Walter a question, you take one of these pieces of paper and you write your question down. And then when I say, all right, I'm taking the questions, around 7, like halfway through, you're going to pass all these questions up to here, and, you know, then in a little while, we'll have him answer them. And that'll be great, okay? So think, what could I ask Walter? What could I ask this guy? Because he's going to be mobbed by people. Maybe you're a shy person. Here's your chance to ask what you want to ask. Now, I wanted to bring another faculty person up here. I wanted to bring you, Jeff, but you refused. That's okay. You're tired. That's all right. I wanted to bring David Gordon up here. Because the thing about David Gordon is he knows everything. And you think I'm joking. You think, well, okay, yeah, he's a smart guy, whatever. It's ridiculous how much this guy knows. Talk to him privately. If there's some question in philosophy or history or intellectual history or economics that you're interested in, ask him about it. Or ask, well, what can I read on such and such topic? Or I'm pursuing this research avenue. What can I do? I do this constantly. I saved up a couple questions on Aristotle to ask him while I was down here. Because it's ridiculous. And in fact, I listened to him give a talk once, and this has happened numerous times. He's talking about Aristotle, and he references an article in the Review of Metaphysics by Roderick here. And off the top of his head, with no notes, he also knows the page numbers. Like, that's not, like, normal. So I wanted to have him come up here for Stump David Gordon. And he's too modest to do it, I think. Because you can't stump him, right? Where would the fun in that have been? How could I have given out prizes? So maybe I'll persuade him to do that next year. But I just want you to have a sense, though, before we go on, of how extraordinary a group of people they really are, these folks who are going to spend a lot of time with you this week, and you're going to be very impressed by them. Now, speaking of Walter Block and spending time, after this session is over, there's a kind of an oddball item in your schedule. There is a chess match scheduled between Walter and me, and the origin of that is a couple years ago, some of the graduate student fellows here had a chess tournament, and I was the only American in the tournament. It was 6 or 7 people plus me, and they were all Europeans or something. And like all Americans, I have an inferiority complex vis-a-vis Europeans. I feel like they're always smarter than I am, and I'm not worthy to stand in their presence. And so I was very nervous about being in this chess tournament. And the first game of the tournament, I lost ignominiously. And I thought, well, that just goes to show I'm terrible at this. I have no business being in this tournament. Then I ended up winning every single game in the rest of the tournament, and I won. So, of course, you know me. I went around the Institute chanting, USA, USA. And so we decided, without really consulting him, that the winner would play against Walter, who's a good chess player. So 2 years ago, Walter beat me. So then, of course, we had a rematch last year, and I beat him. Interestingly, the only one of these two games that's on YouTube is the one that I won. I don't know how that happened, but you can find it on YouTube. So tonight, given that we've each won one game, tonight is like, this is it, right? This is it. I mean, which one of us is the man and which one of us is the goat is going to be decided right here before you. And you may say, I don't really fancy watching a chess game. It is optional, but I'm telling you, you're going to be drawn to it. There's an excitement. There's an electricity in the room. As a matter of fact, I forgot. I was supposed to go up and get my chess clock. We're playing 20 minutes aside, and that's it. All right, so having said all that, let's see. Is there anything else I want to say? Yeah, I do want to say one more thing before I bring up my first person. My first person is two people. That's why we've got the three seats here. I have a brother-in-law who's here. I'm not going to identify him so that you guys don't pester him the whole time and ask him questions. We'll let him absorb this on his own. So, in fact, I won't even look in his general direction. I'll just go like this. But just for his sake, I want to sort of just explain, like in 2 minutes, what it is that we're all about, what it is that we're doing here. And so I kind of did that last night, but the Institute is centered around the Austrian School of Economics. You guys all know that. But the insight that I was trying to ram home last night in the talk was that as libertarians, we more or less believe that society runs itself without the need for some external force, as I call it, a guy with a bullhorn shouting out orders at everybody, that we don't need that, that's superfluous, society just runs itself. Well, the economy can run itself, is what you notice when you read Man, Economy, and State by Murray Rothbard. It's a long book, and you notice that chapter after chapter, he's building this beautiful edifice of economics from beginning from one isolated person, Robinson Crusoe, and then continuing on to two people, and then building up into a sophisticated modern economy. And all this time, there is no role for a guy with a bullhorn. In other words, a politician telling people what to do or taxing people or shifting resources around. He's utterly superfluous to the whole process. And then at the end of the book, you see that when he does come along, all he can do is screw up the process. And so this is very counterintuitive because we're inclined to think, because we're raised on what I call this military metaphor, that if you want to get things done, you need some guy in charge of everything. And yet it's astonishing how much gets accomplished. For example, all economic activity can be accomplished without some guy with a hangman's noose and a gun and threats of imprisonment and taxation. It just happens, and this is astonishing. And then the other part of it is the Institute itself is named after, it's not called the Austrian Economics Institute, it's named after Ludwig von Mises to honor him and his work in particular, because not only was he a great scholar, but he was a great hero in the way he lived his life. This is a guy who, when he's, 31 years old, he writes a treatise on the theory of money and credit that if you were to read today, you would say, well, this actually does help to account for why we're in the terrible economic mess we're in today. And he wrote it 100 years ago. Or the guy has to flee from the Nazis in 1940, coming all the way to the United States with his wife, almost empty-handed, in his late 50s. And you would think, well, that's going to be the end of his career there. I mean, how's he going to start a whole new academic career when he's almost 60? In a foreign country, I mean, he spoke some English, but when he would write books, Henry Hazlitt had to help with it. And yet, he has the most productive phase of his whole career at that time, and he absolutely refuses to concede anything. He's fighting against the whole tide of world history at that point, which is all centered around the idea of state intervention into the economy. And he's saying, the intervention is going to make the problems that you're trying to solve worse. The cure is worse than the disease. And he's been completely vindicated because we're living through the end of a business cycle whose ups and downs can be accounted for by theories that he pioneered. And while almost everybody else who taught at his university has been long forgotten, we have the Ludwig von Mises Institute and all you guys, and it turns out we could only accept less than 1/3 of all the applicants, of all people who want to come here during their summer and spend a whole week learning what this guy was teaching. That's really astonishing. And so that's why I'm so excited to have a chance to be here. Okay, so here are our first people. Oh, okay, wait. I have not kept up to my end of this bargain.
We'll carry you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I'm now going to leave my privileged enclave here and move over to the seats. Here we go. So the first couple people I want to bring up are people who are going to be entertaining you later in the week. Now, you may have noticed on the schedule that there is provision made for a concert on Friday night. And you may think, well, this is something I wasn't expecting at an economics conference, but I'm game for anything. Good, that's just the right attitude. Let me tell you what the wrong attitude is. Well, gee, it's 11 o'clock, and I got to be in bed by then. No, you are retroactively rejected from Mises University, if that's your thinking. No. This is, I don't want to say it's the highlight of the week, because then that'll make the professors feel bad, but it's an awesome part of the week. Because this band is fronted by two people who are 100% Misesians. So like they go from show to show and they're listening to Mises Institute podcasts. So I thought, I'm not going to get a chance to talk to people like this all that often. So I would like to welcome Matt and Pacey Harris up here. So come on up here. Fun. All right. Hey, all right. Good to see you. Okay. Hey, great to see you. Okay. All right. Okay. So let's see. Yeah. Why don't you sit here and then we'll chit chat. Okay. So this is your microphone. You guys can share this one. There we go. All right.
How do you use this?
Yeah, exactly. You're pretty familiar with how this works. All right. So first of all, we'll get into the Austrian stuff in a minute, but tell us about your band. It's called Fly By Radio. So what makes it so awesome? See, I'm such an incisive interviewer, right?
He makes it awesome. Well, we try to do a big production, and we do classic rock. We play stuff that everybody knows, so it's a lot of fun.
The reason it's fun
high energy.
Everybody comes out from the instant. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Gotta get closer.
Yeah.
What makes it fun for you guys is Bob Murphy comes up and does a little lead vocals, and I don't know if anybody knows, but I mean he's also a karaoke superstar. So live band karaoke with Bob Murphy.
Yeah, but no lyrics, Bob. So.
Yeah. It's a little more pressure, so y'all cut them some slack. But we've done it 2 years in a row, and it's always a good time. Mm-hmm.
Now, what I like about get that. Yeah, so what I like about you guys is that you look at them, right? They say they're lovely people, right? And soft spoken and sweet. Wait till you see them Friday night. It's like they're completely different people. that just knocked my socks off. And then, like to me, like. What's weird is that you guys come to the Mises Institute and you're saying that, from your point of view, the Mises faculty are like superstars for you guys. But then, like in the intermission of your show, and you guys came up to the VIP section where we were all sitting, I sort of thought like, yeah, I know these people. Yeah. I mean, so
it was a big deal for us when we first came, and we've been driving around a lot, listening to a lot of Mises podcasts because we'll be on the road for several hours at a time, and I'm just hearing Floyd Lilly talking to my ear, and then we come and meet her, and it's just you hear that voice, and I'm just like, "You've been reading to me for
she does
for
a lot months. Of audiobooks.
Right? Yeah, I love it. So yeah, it's just I don't know. Meeting everybody here for the first time has been amazing, but we have it set up where how's everybody getting in? Everybody gets in for free.
Yeah, we'll figure out some way. We usually do bracelets.
We do something like that. Where anyway, everybody's invited. Y'all come out. Wanted.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's great. All right, so now, why don't we have you tell people why it is that in this particular show, you will be opening with some songs and closing with some songs, but not doing all the vocal work this time.
I'm retiring. I'm going to have a baby on Thanksgiving Day. So this will be my last show in Auburn. Thank you. we're married. We've been married for a long time.
What is interesting about that, and I just thought of this earlier, I remember when I first kind of got introduced in Austrian economics, a lot of people, it's different books. For me, it was Economics in One Lesson, and I was listening to the an audiobook, and I was like standing in my fence, and it took like 5 hours, so I had that thing running. And I remember it just opened my eyes, but I ran inside, and I was like, Pacey, I want our kids to understand this stuff. And this was like 5 years ago, you know, and so it's just kind of, just because I know it's the truth. And so it just, I don't know. I'm just kind of happy to have someone, you know, a new part of our family. And I've just kind of always wanted them to understand this, I guess.
Yeah. The way we got into Austrian economics, my dad is Austrian but doesn't know it, you know. And so he's explaining to us how our monetary system works. And we're like, well, really? We got to research this a little further. And it led us to the Mises Institute and then to Ron Paul and then everybody, and it just snowballed from there. And it's, you guys, before we met you guys, y'all are already famous to us because we watch you all the time. Isn't it weird?
That is totally weird, yes.
But you guys know what I mean.
So how long have you guys been performing?
Oh, 11 years. Yeah,
11 years.
We've been together for 11 years and married for 5 and been performing the whole time.
Now, what about the rest of the band? Do they think you're a little eccentric or
weird.
Talk to them about this stuff? Or?
Yeah, they think we're weird. We've tried.
You know how it goes when you have the talk, the free market talk, and then it doesn't work, but you're still around that person. And then certain topics come up, like this week, hey, Detroit's bankrupt. They're like, as a city go bankrupt? I'm like, I don't know, you know? We've had the talk. So, yeah, it's different, you know, traveling with somebody after having the talk. Y'all know.
I'm sure we get on their nerves at times. Everything leads to an economic conversation sometimes.
We were on their nerves during the Ron Paul campaign, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, I want you to explain to me what you told me some time ago about how the lighting works in the show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because it seems like you've got some incredible lighting team that comes along with you.
Oh,
but it turns out that that's an illusion.
Yeah, we have a whole self-contained light show. It's because we're like an 80s cover band, hence the hair, but... So it's all kind of ran from the stage. So if you see this crazy light show going on, it's just me running it with my feet, you know, while I'm playing guitar. And we do all sorts of parties and stuff, so we kind of have to.
Yeah, so he's playing guitar, and he's also doing the lights.
And he's running sound and wearing spandex and eyeliner.
Wow. I thought I'd leave some things for them to discover on their own.
They need a warning.
Right. So now you've had Bob come up the past 2 years.
Right.
Yeah, and
right.
this is so great because half the people in there are just regular Auburn goers.
Mm-hmm.
They have no idea why the rest of us are cheering like crazy for Bob.
Right, yeah. Mosh pitting here in Sweet Caroline.
Yeah. So you don't have to give anything away, but is there anything planned for this year?
He's going
to
do it again, yeah.
Can't say what song.
Yeah.
Oh, can't say what song, okay. Nice. Nice. All right, what else can we talk about?
I practiced during karaoke tonight. No.
All right, what's the most insane performing story you have? Crazy venue or the stage collapses or, you know, you lost a limb or something. Like what have you got?
We can't talk about it, I don't think.
Oh, that's the best kind. Have a glass of wine like me. You'll be blah, blah, blah before
We've
you
We've seen
know
people
it.
That have had way too many glasses of wine. And,
yeah. It's your shows, you mean?
Right.
Yeah. I don't know anybody like that.
Oh gosh, let me think. I don't know.
We gotta pass.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to pass on that.
Oh, okay. All right, fair enough.
There's a girl out there that her haircut and outfit is out of style now. From the pictures that were going around.
Oh, I see.
Too much wine.
Yeah, you guys take pictures of the crowd and post them on your site.
Oh yeah, but not bad ones. This was someone else.
Okay.
Right, yeah, we take pictures of every show and put them online so you guys get out there and get nuts and you'll be on our website forever.
But like you guys, like from the stage, like you were promoting the Mises Institute. Like again, these are a lot of drunk Auburn students, and we're all cheering, so they start cheering. Like whatever the heck this thing is, I'm in favor of it.
Got my Rothbard tie on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Matt is wearing, but Matt has a stage persona that goes by another name. But Matt is wearing his Rothbard enemy of the state shirt while playing guitar. You can do that this.
It's a very
time.
Rock and roll shirt.
Yeah, it's totally a rock shirt.
That's the best shirt.
Yeah,
I love it. So yeah, I wear it. We're at a pretty good bit, but always for Mises.
Yeah.
For Mises,
yeah. That's really great. That's really great. Well, listen, you guys are great. Everybody's going to be there, right? We're all going? Yay! All right. Thank you, guys. All right. Good. All right. During this transition moment, we will have a little wine. Okay. Now for my next trick. Now for the next my next guest is our friend. Let me introduce him for you, Patrick Newman. Now, let me tell you who Patrick Newman is. So he's just graduated from Rutgers University, and he's going to be starting a PhD program in the fall. Okay, good. In economics, and he is the winner of the first place prize in the oral exam last year. So that means he walked out of here with 2,500 big ones. So he's a guy you want to get to know because you want to find out a little inside story about how did he do this, right? What is this thing like? How did you win that kind of dough? Well, Patrick Newman, it is your turn to come on up here. So let's do some chit-chatting. All right, thanks. All right, good. Oh, yeah, let's start. Moving your questions for Walter. Pass them down this way. Questions for Walter. You definitely got some. And I bet some of you actually want to ask him that petunia question, don't you? If half the petunias become rational, do all 100% of them get rights? If we get nothing else, I'm asking him that. All right, so anyway. Oh, we're awfully close, aren't we?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, actually, you can have this.
Oh. Thank you.
Okay, so all right, so Patrick wins the prize, right? $2,500. Now, let me just start off by saying that one thing we've noticed over the years is that with the internet growing and the website growing, we get students coming to this program now who are much more knowledgeable about Austrian economics than students used to be in the past because they've read all the materials online, they're knowledgeable about it. And we've had cases in some exams where the student has been so intelligent that the faculty has basically said, this person should be on this side of the table with us asking the questions. Like, we get people that bright. Patrick wasn't one of those, but he was very impressive because you were an undergrad at the time, right?
Yeah.
So this, yeah, he's an undergrad, and he wins the prize where everybody is eligible to be in it. Well, not everybody. The faculty's excluded, but the grad students are eligible, and this undergrad won it, and he escaped with his life. But what was – okay, first of all, we start off with this written test, okay? If you you've been paying attention and studying the stuff, you should be okay on the written test.
Yeah.
Now the written test thing, though, if you don't pass through to the next round, to the oral part, that doesn't mean you failed the test. It means that they have to have a cutoff. Like, it has to be, if it's 20 questions, and we have a whole bunch of people who got 17 or more, then 17 or more is going to be the cutoff. So if you got 16, that doesn't mean you failed. It just means that other people did better. So you shouldn't go home saying, I'm the worst person ever. I don't know any Austrian economics. Why don't I just quit now? Don't think that. Do not think that. So, all right, but is it scary being in the oral exam? I mean, when you're Mr. First Place, I'm sure it probably isn't, but like, does it, do you seem like, you think people would be scared doing this?
I don't really need the mic, but I'd say it really depends on how comfortable you are at speaking economics, you know, talking economics. I mean, one thing I think that it really shows how well you know something is if you can speak it to others, if you can teach it. And I know teachers of any, it doesn't have to deal with economics at all, but it's how well you can articulate your ideas. So if you have a bunch of stuff jumbled in your brain, and even though you might be really bright, and you could deliberate on something, and you could take about, you know, it might take half an hour to get a reasoned response. That's not the type of, you know, the oral exam is different. I mean, it's really lightning fast. You know, they ask you a question, and you got to be on your toes. So it is one of those things. So if you're good at comfort public speaking, you're comfortable, and you can think, you know, rationally during something like that. You know, you can think coolly and calmly. Then, I mean, it can be something manageable, but. I mean, before anyone takes it, I'll be honest, I was nervous for the first time I took it. And I mean, each time you do, because you never know what's going to happen.
So do you think there are some faculty members who are kind of tougher than others, or some that are kind of pushovers? Like, why don't you just tell us? Because what's going to happen is you'll be, if you get through to the oral part, we have three different exam rooms going at once, so we have time to examine everybody. And so you'll look and see which faculty members are going to be in your room. And there might be certain names that if you see them in your room, you say, don't. You know, like when you were trying to get your driver's license, you knew that there was one of the troopers was terrible. He's going to make you parallel park. Who's going to make you parallel park here at the Mises Institute?
Well, I do think actually they don't even post the teacher, the professor's names on at least
oh, they just post the student names.
Yeah, they just post the student
and then
names.
You walk in there and say, oh.
So half of it becomes an inside game as to figure out who's
that's
which
funny.
Place. Yeah. But I would have to say the toughest person without a doubt is Guido Holzman.
Yeah.
I mean he really drills the questions he asks you, and then he stares at you with this very stoic German face.
With a slight grin.
This grin,
and,
yes.
And you don't
grin.
Know if that means, have I made a fool of myself or am I awesome?
Yeah, before and after you, the question. So it can break the character of the most, you know, hard, fast men. But yeah, it's fun. He's definitely the hardest, I would say.
But he's not here this year.
Yeah, he's not here this year.
So the faculty, no applauding that. So the faculty, we're now talking to each other secretly about, so who's going to be Guido this year? Like, who's going to be the Guido? I don't know. I mean, I think you need to have a German accent to really be that intimidating. Yeah. So we'll see.
Yeah. After Guido, I mean, he I always remembered was the toughest.
And he would ask questions that sometimes the rest of the faculty would not really always know what the answer was. But he said, well, look, we have to distinguish the best from the second best, right? We have to ask tough questions.
The good news is if I remember the rules right, whoever you have, if you go on to the second round, whoever the speaker, you know, who were testing you the first round, they can't ask you questions. in the second round.
Right. So the first, the first round would be like the written exam. Then you get to the oral.
Yeah,
they narrow that down. And then there's a final round where you're in a room with every faculty member, but the ones who have already examined you can't ask you anything. So if you get people you perceive as being tough in the first round, you're home free. They're not allowed to ask you anything anymore.
Yeah. So it works both ways. So, you know, you could have the tough guys, but if you go on, then you could be in a relatively better position. But yeah, the last round's especially intimidating because you have the whole faculty looking at you. This is this long round table. It's the tech room now, but yeah, it was this long round, like business table. You sit at the very end, and they all lean over.
Yeah.
They look at you, and you're kind of like.
Nice. Okay, so now you've also been a summer fellow here.
Yeah.
2 years.
Yeah.
Right. So was that useful to you? After the Institute has poured a lot of resources into you, did you find that useful?
Very, very enjoyable summer. Probably the two most enjoyable summers I've had in a while. Tremendously helpful. You're here and you research and you can write a few. You write a paper and you discuss with faculty and other fellows here and you pretty much in a sense it really is a consumption good because you're able to do if you're really interested in the academic stuff, you do what you love and it's a tremendous benefit to be able to do that, to be able to. Most of the time, most kids, college kids, they got to write a paper and, it's the end of the world. They write the paper, 5 hours before class. But, here, you really want to enjoy what you're doing. And I certainly do. It's a great time.
Nice. Yeah. All right. What else do you want to add about your time here? Or advice to them or anything?
The advice.
Or tell them what questions are on the exam. I think it's what they're really waiting for. Yeah.
Well, I do know they change it a while. The oral exam, the multiple choice questions, it's all on the basic lectures that everyone takes. So the special lectures that you take, you might take, you take the DiLorenzo session where, he talks about, political entrepreneurship and stuff. You know those questions, you just pretty much mainline, the hardcore,
for the written
economics.
And then in the oral, they can ask you about the breakout ones.
You submit which sessions you've been to, and then they ask you questions based on that. So, a question would pretty much be, someone would ask, how do you define inflation? So, I know Holzman would always ask this, so I could say Holzman's question, because, he won't be here. So you would answer, and then he would continue with it. So depending on how you answered that question, he would go on. So, if you gave, it's an increase in prices, it's not really how the Austrians would say it. He'd sort of engage you on that. If not, he'd say, okay, an increase in the money supply. If you go the Rothbard route, increase the money supply that was unbacked by gold. It all depends. So pretty much one question leads to another during the oral.
Yeah, and then when you get to the last round, it's anything goes.
Yeah,
like, we can ask you, because we got to see who really is the most knowledgeable. So we can ask
they try
anything.
They try and break you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. All right, good.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, Patrick, thanks. All right.
Pleasure inviting me.
All right, thanks. All right. All right, now this leaves us with a really juicy amount of time to talk rational petunias here with my dear friend, Professor Walter Block, everybody. Woo! All right, thank you. All right, so I've had a couple of my friends go through and organize these by topic so that I'm not having to do that myself. Yeah, you can take this. But before we do this, so you got your PhD at Columbia, and so did Murray Rothbard. But how did you guys meet? May people be interested in knowing that?
Jerry Wallows and Larry Moss were roommates, and Larry Moss was a fellow student of mine, and he kept saying, you must meet this guy, Murray Rothbard. But Murray Rothbard was an anarchist. So I thought that was crazy, so I didn't want to meet him. And finally, they ganged up on me and prevailed upon me to meet Murray Rothbard. And I challenged him on the anarchy thing, and he converted me in about 5 minutes. It was the quickest. Like, I was into the Hazlitt economics in one lesson where, you have the weeding out process, and that's why we have pretty good shoes and whatever. And he said, well, let's apply that to police. Let's apply it to courts. Let's apply it to armies, whatever. And he had me going. The Austrianism took a long, long time. He had a picture of Mises, and I used to say to him, well, Mises isn't an anarchist. Why do you have a picture of Mises on? And he was very tolerant of me. I mean, that was a crazy question, and pretty insulting, too. But He was very generous with me, and I sort of devote my life to passing on the baton that he gave to me and my cohort, and try to pass it on to the next group.
Before we go on, though, you have published so much in academic journals. Do you have any general advice to students with regard to publishing?
Yeah, never give up. I have had articles rejected by about 25 or 30 different journals. And my attitude when they reject it is pearls before swine. So I just send it out again. And it takes about a half a year to get a rejection, sometimes much less, sometimes much more. So if you get 30 rejections, that's 15 years on average. But I believe in the stuff I write. Very rarely do I give up on something because a referee said it was wrong and I see that I was wrong, but that's very rare. Usually I believe that, you know, pearls before swine, and I just send it to somebody else, and eventually I get pretty much everything I write published.
Now, you've written so much that my favorite Walter Block story is you didn't realize that you had already reviewed a particular book, so you reviewed it twice.
I'm getting a little Alzheimer-ish. It's even worse than that. One time I wrote a book review, and then I forgot I wrote the book review, and I wrote another review of the same book. And even worse is it's sort of like almost intellectual incest, or even worse than that, like I'll read something that I wrote a long time ago, and I forgot that I wrote it. And I'm starting to say, yeah, this is good stuff. And, you know, but I wrote it. I mean, you can't get sicker than that.
All right, let's dive in here. I'm dying to ask you about the petunias. I thought about that at random. But suppose, okay, so half the petunias are rational. Do all 100% of the petunias, are they all entitled to rights now?
Well, thank God I had a few minutes to think about that.
Good.
That was a tough one. This all comes about from the question that Murray Rothbard was asked, namely about animal rights. Suppose you meet a porpoise or a monkey that is twice as smart as any of the ones that we've got, and they're the smartest of the animals. When do they get rights? And what Murray said, and I see no reason to disagree with him on that, is two things. One, they petition for their rights in some way. They have to say, or squeak, or something, to indicate that they respect their rights and that they're demanding or asking for their rights to be respected. And two, they have to respect our rights. When I told it to my son, he said, "You better hope there's not one intelligent mosquito."
Who writes out a petition for his rights.
Right. One intelligent mosquito, and then they all get their rights. But I think the way to get around that question of how many is it's a continuum problem, and there are no right answers to continuum problems. They're just gray areas. The examples I usually use is statutory rape laws. We know that if you go to bed with a 5-year-old girl, you're a statutory rapist, and if you go to bed with a 25-year-old woman, you're not. Well, what about 15, 14, 16? You know, where is the right number? And there is no right number. It's arbitrary. You have to go by culture or something like that, the practices of the people. I mean, to me, if it's somewhere between 14 and 18, that's reasonable. If it's 10, that's way too young. And if it's 21, that's way too old. But somewhere in there. I don't know. That's just sort of my own feel for that, you know, what the right age for statutory rape is. But it's not just statutory rape. Suppose I now put my fist near Tom, and he shoots me in self-defense. Well, how close does my fist have to be? Well, 6 inches, 6 feet, what? It's the context. It's the reasonable man. It's, you know, if it's in the middle of the night in a dark alley, and he doesn't know what's going on, then it can be pretty far away, and he can now take action against me. On the other hand, in this context, even if I get close, given this sort of a context, and if he started shooting me, he would be the aggressor. So where is the right line? For the petunias, is it 40% of the petunias, 60% of the petunias? It's hard to say. So that's why you need courts. I mean, you can't deduce everything from the non-aggression principle in private property rights. You have to have some sort of common sense and feel for the culture and the traditions of the people. So I would say that if the petunias or the monkeys or the porpoises or whoever they are get much smarter and they petition for our rights and they promise to respect our rights, and they do, well, look, even humans violate rights too. You know, what are the percentage of criminals? 4 or 5%? So you know, there could be some numbers that even humans wouldn't have rights because too many of us are violating rights.
Right. So the occasional lion who has rights may still eat somebody, but that doesn't invalidate it. It's not going to spoil it for all the lions.
Right. If the lions shape up and become rational and, you know, almost as good as people.
All right. Let's dig into the questions. All right. So this is kind of a really more of a Bob Murphy question in a sense because it's about global warming, and Bob just testified before the U.S. Senate, so that means he's knowledgeable about this stuff. But we already knew independently that he was knowledgeable about this. And Barbara Boxer didn't like him, so we love Bob even all the more because of that. So if Bob wants to jump in on this at some point during the week, he's free to do that. But what is the libertarian solution to global warming, assuming it exists? And it says, in other words, how do you privatize the atmosphere? Well, that phraseology seems like a Walter Block question to me.
Well, I think the burden of proof is on those people who say that there is global warming, and not only global warming, but not global warming from sunspots or whatever it is, man-made global warming. And they haven't even come close to assessing that burden. But let's hypotheticalize and assume that they demonstrate this. Well, then, if you use carbon or whatever, it's as if you're shooting someone. I mean, if we're going to fry and we're all going to die because we have global warming, then whenever we contribute to global warming, it's assault and battery against other people. And then we would have some sort of justification, not in the government, God forbid, stopping this, but in private courts, private police telling people that you're doing that. It's akin to assault and battery or rape or murder or whatever. So I think that would be the logical implication, if they could but prove it. But, you know, they have this, they call it deniers, and they have this East Anglia people where they're not allowing dissenters to publish. And, I mean, it's just chicanery. And, you know, the way these people started in the 70s, it was global cooling, and therefore capitalism is to blame. And then in the 90s, it was global warming, and capitalism is to blame. But then we didn't have much global warming, so now they talk about climate change, which is always changing, and therefore it's capitalism's fault. So they've got the verdict set. It's capitalism's fault, and the indictment keeps changing. So they've come nowhere near meeting any burden of proof at all. So it's not a practical thing, but if, hypothetical. This sort of reminds me of Bob Barr when he was running for the Libertarian presidency on the Libertarian Party ticket. He was asked, well, suppose you were running for president, would you legalize drugs? He says, well, no, I'm saying it wrong. Suppose you were running for president and you would you favor legalizing drugs? He said, well, that's a state issue. I can't answer it. It's too hypothetical. So then they said, well, suppose you were governor, would you legalize drugs? He says, well, I'm not running for governor, I'm running for president, so I can't answer it. Just a way of trying to, I mean, that's the way the politicians get out of hypotheticals. But I think that hypotheticals are eminently reasonable. I mean, if we want to stretch our theory, we have to be able to be willing to deal with hypotheticals. So I hope I've done that.
Okay, how about this one? Let's see. Well, this is two questions, but they're interesting. Well, the first one, I already know your answer. Would you press a button to get rid of the state tomorrow? Why or why not? Well, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, I knew that. I'm not even going to give you the why or why not, because I want to get to more of these. But will we reach a stateless society via reform of existing government institutions or in some other way? Hard to know the answer to that,
isn't it? I don't think we'll ever do it. I don't think we're going to reach nirvana or anarcho-capitalism, at least until people change, because my view is that we're biologically hardwired not to appreciate free enterprise. You know, the sociobiological theory is that we are hardwired into doing that which meant longer life and more kids into the next generation a million years ago when we were in the trees or in the caves. That's what sociobiology is. For example, everybody here is afraid of snakes. If there was a snake crawling around, we'd all go like that. No one's afraid of bathtubs, and yet bathtubs kill many more people than snakes nowadays. Why? Because we are biologically set to be afraid of snakes, because if you were afraid of snakes a million years ago, you left more children than if you go over to the snake and pat him on the head and ask him if he's a friendly snake. Whereas it meant no biological advantage to be afraid of bathtubs then, so we're not afraid of bathtubs, even though they kill us more than snakes do nowadays. Well, I think that we are biologically predisposed to have explicit cooperation. Like if this young man started writhing around, we'd call on a doctor and we'd all be very nervous. We'd try to help him. So, because in the good old days in the tribe, if he was sick this week and I helped him and next week I was sick and he helped me, our tribe would survive. Whereas your crappy tribe, you know, you all didn't help each other, you would all die. So we're biologically hardwired to help each other based on explicit cooperation. But there's such a thing as implicit cooperation, namely the free enterprise system, which is implicit cooperation. Like in the aftermath of the Katrina hurricane in New Orleans, the prices rose very high. And we as economists know when the prices rise, it's a signal to bring more stuff in, and it's also a signal to divvy up the stuff in some equitable way so that everyone gets a little bit at a higher price. Otherwise, the first people in line at the Walmart are going to grab it all at the old low price. So we know that because we're different. We've overcome our biological limitations. But most people say, what? They're gouging. They're engaged in price gouging. And we are biologically, most of us, I mean, look, we're only 1% or 0.5% or 2%. Most of the people viscerally, biologically feel that price gouging is exploitative. And so until and unless I think we overcome this biological predisposition in against free enterprise, we're not going to get there. Now, maybe in 100,000 years or a million years, our biology will change. So I think it's a biological question as to why there are so few of us, why Ron Paul only gets, you know, 1% or 3% or 5%, and he's reviled by everybody.
All right. Now, I know that you've written an enormous amount on the subject of the market and the environment. So I do want to take a couple of these questions and sort of merge them into one. I know that a lot of the ways you can answer environmentalist objections is to talk about property rights and, hey, if you don't want to see such and such species go extinct, then just buy them and raise them yourself or whatever. But for some people, that's just going to seem like, but there's no way I possibly could, and so you're saying that my preferences have no weight at all just because I can't bring to bear all the funds that would be necessary to preserve them. I'm prejudicing the question by starting that way, but how can one discuss libertarianism with environmentalists? How can the market protect the environment? I mean, I know you've done so much on this. And then specifically, somebody asks, what would be the free market solution for the companies which are killing honeybees? Which I think is somewhat related to the environment question. So what's your basic, I mean, suppose you've got 3 to 5 minutes to talk to an environmentalist who hates your guts. How are you going to handle that?
You know, I was once in a debate with a guy who didn't hate my guts because he didn't really understand what it was. He was a biologist, and when he finally understood what I was talking about, free market environmentalism, he burst out laughing. And it wasn't a purposeful laugh, you know, to undermine me. It was an honest laugh. He just thought it was hilarious that the market could help with the environment. That's crazy. Well, with regard to the example I like to use is the cow and the buffalo. They're the same animal. They're big and fat and smelly, and they give milk and they have horns and this and that. And yet one never came within a million miles of extinction because it was always owned privately, the cow, and the buffalo was not owned. You know, we had the dances with wolves and the home on the range and all that other socialist crap. the reason that the buffalo were in trouble is no one owned them. And the answer is you didn't have to personally own a buffalo any more than you have to open up a jacket factory in order to get jackets. We have specialization in division of labor. As long as somebody is allowed to own the buffalo, and as far as I'm concerned, the elephant is just a buffalo with a funny nose, and, you know, it's the same principle. And there are countries that like Botswana that allow a little bit more private ownership than others, and the herds increase there. And nowadays, you can own buffaloes, and all of a sudden, the buffaloes are not in danger. And the same with the crocodiles and the alligators and any animal, any species at all. People say, well, the reason that the elephant and the rhino are going extinct is because they have valuable tusks or valuable horns or whatever. No, the reason is they're not owned. And if they're owned, then people protect them, and they will allow you to shoot one. And they'll have different prices. You know, you can shoot an old male elephant or an old female elephant for a lot cheaper than a young female elephant. You want to shoot a young female elephant, this could be an arm and a leg. because young females are the limit on biology. It's no accident that the farmer keeps one bull and 50 cows and not the other way around, because if he did, 49 of the the bulls would be superfluous. So these are examples of if you really want to save species, you have to privatize them. And it's the same for the bumblebee or the whale. You have to get into privatization of the ocean, which I will do in one of my lectures. I'll be doing something on private property rights on oceans and rivers and lakes and roads and highways. But I think that it's incontrovertible that if you want to save species, you privatize them. And we have a tragedy of the commons. When we all own something in common, then we don't take care of it. There's this woman, Eleanor Ostrom, who recently won a Nobel Prize in economics, who completely screwed that up, and she doesn't understand what public property is, and I've got a few articles attacking her. So that would be my 3 or 4 minute spiel on trying to convert an environmental person, I call them the watermelons because they're green on the outside but red on the inside. I mean, a lot of them, you know, they had a good thing going with communism. I mean, you know, you talk about the man with the bullhorn. They like people with bullhorns. And communism was going great. There were a lot of bullhorns there. And then all of a sudden communism went bad. And they needed another horse to attach their wagon to, and they hit upon environmentalism. So these people aren't really open to being converted. But if you meet an environmentalist who's open and honest, you can try the private property rights thing. I think that's what works.
All right, let me take the host prerogative for a follow-up here. Now, on the subject of air pollution, we always recommend the famous Rothbard article. So if you haven't read
Air Pollution Property...
What is it called?
I forget the long title. Yeah, it starts with air pollution.
Gosh, I'm getting old.
Yes.
Something like... Or maybe it's the wine.
The wine. It's the wine.
It's something about air pollution, property rights, and some third thing. But it actually goes well beyond air pollution, this article. It's great.
It's the best thing ever written on environmentalism.
But the objection... Basically, what's being argued there is that our position, and like Walter's position, would be that when you have these... Sometimes you read about this supposedly market idea of having tradable pollution rights or pollution credits, and that this makes certain that when you have to engage in pollution abatement, the abatement will take place in those firms where it's the cheapest to engage in the abatement, and so the social cost of pollution abatement will be minimized. And this is a way of introducing some kind of market mechanism. Walter's view of this is that this is just more pinko central planning, because where do these tradable rights come from? This is just a totally arbitrary construct. But couldn't somebody come back at you and say, but your argument that basically all this should just be referred to the courts is so slow and inefficient, and meanwhile I'm choking to death and all my kids are dead and they have black lungs because we're using Walter Block's approach. I mean, surely you have to concede the state has a role here.
Well, yeah, now
that was that argument.
I've been converted. No, I'm kidding. One of the arguments that Murray deals with is it'd be silly to try to sue every automobile owner, because each automobile owner contributes just a teeny bit of pollution, and therefore it'd be silly, you know, sue you. You'd have to sue everybody, and it would be just, as a practical matter, impossible. And Murray says, little drum roll, private property rights. If you had private highways and private streets, you wouldn't have to sue each car owner. You'd sue the street owner for having a bawdy house of pollution or something like that. Namely, there are many fewer highway owners than car owners. And if you sued the whole, you know, there might be, I don't know, 300 highway and street owners in the whole country or something like that, and it'd be a lot easier to sue them. So the reason it's so impractical in the first place is because of prior government ownership. I mean, it's the same thing like with the paparazzi and privacy rights. That's because the sidewalks are owned by the government. If the sidewalks were private, then the sidewalk owners would make rules, and if they wanted to attract people like our rock and roll stars who everyone wants to take a picture of, well, then they would set their policies such as to protect them. So the problem is a prior problem of lack of private property rights in the first place. If private property rights were open, then there would be a much more rational system. In the 1830s, and Murray goes into this, you did have lawsuits, and it worked pretty well. Perfectly, no, but pretty well. And then in the 1890s, with the progressive period, then the next time somebody came into court and said, industry is polluting my lungs and my lawns and my laundry, they would say, yeah, they're violating your property rights. You're thinking lousy, selfish private property rights. There's something more important than that. It's the public good. And what does the public good consist of? Manufacturing, because we want to kick Great Britain's butt. And the way you do that is by getting a heavy industry. So I think it's very practical to the Murray Rothbard piece is very practical in this regard.
All right, let's close up with this one. How can you answer contentions that without Roman or English imperialism, Europe and America would never have developed? So you needed the state to open these things or to clear out the barbarians, so-called, and we needed Caesar in Gaul, or if you didn't have that, then the Germanic tribes would have come in. We'd never have had civilization. I mean, that's what they say.
You know, there's a joke in economics. One economist asks the other economist, how's your wife? And the response is, compared to what? It's not a very good joke. I mean, it's an economics joke, so, you know, what can you expect? But this is contrary to factual hypothetical history. We compared to what? We don't know what would have happened. That's a gigantic question. If we didn't have imperialism, maybe the Martians would have invaded or who knows what. So I don't think that's a really good challenge to those of us who oppose imperialism. I mean, you might as well say the same thing, that if we didn't drop the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, something better would have happened, or we killed the next Hitler. I mean, you can never prove anything like that. It's just totally hypothetical. It's just made up to support imperialism.
All right, and with that, let's see, we're a couple minutes early, but we got to set up the board for the chess thing. I hope this went okay, but it's always fun talking to Walter, right? And I have a pile of these things, but if you didn't get your question answered, he's here all week. And when you see that circle of students, you don't even have to look for the faculty member. You know it's going to be Walter. So, all right, so I think I'll run up and get my clock, and we'll pull a board out to the middle. So you can stick around and be with us, or you can go drink, or you can drink and then come back and be with us. Whatever you like, but thanks, everybody.